Thank you for having me here. And as usual, I see that that fortuitously, what I'm going to say actually links very nicely with what Dr. Lowenthal was saying. I'm going to base my remarks on certain points that I distill from some of the discourses by the Lubavitch Rebbe, the seventh Lubavitch Rebbe. These were said on Purim in 1962, and then the next one on the Shabbos, the Shabbat, leading into the month of Nisan, and then on the Rebbe's birthday on the 11th of Nisan, the first discourse on that day. He said two discourses on, at the gathering on that day, with some insights drawn also from Shmini Atzeret at the end of 1979. And the issues I want to look at, the many issues are touched on, you can look at these things from endless perspectives, but what I want to focus on, I mean, sometimes you notice, maybe we know some people who became religious, and they became so religious so quickly that you don't recognize them anymore, and they have maybe a little bit of a glazed look, or you try to speak to them in a down-to-earth way, and they're sort of looking past you or something like that, and you can't really relate. You say, is this the same guy I was friendly with 6 months ago? And then what's even more interesting, 2 years later, that person won't be religious at all. as if, you know, something, it came and it went. And that obviously, that's not the most stable thing. I don't want to speak about ecstasy here, a religious experience or a connection with God. And that's one of the problems, I think, that the Rebbe addresses in these discourses. Then we have another problem. The other problem could be that maybe a person always was religious. And at some point in his religious life, he felt alive and he felt inspired. And he's still religious. He's still doing all the religious things, but he's not spiritual anymore. He doesn't have any fire burning him anymore. He doesn't have an inspiration. And there are various other issues that we can notice in the inner life. And so I think that right here, he deals with these issues. What is a healthy progression? What is a healthy growth in one's connection with God, in one's inner life, in one's religious life, in one's spiritual life? Religious and spiritual are not the same thing, obviously. I don't have to elaborate on that. Spiritual, as it sounds, being in touch with higher, maybe an experience, a feeling of something bigger, something beyond the physical. And religious means following, I guess, a certain pattern or certain modes of behavior that come from beyond, but you don't necessarily experience the beyond in what you're doing. So these are two things, they don't always go together. Hopefully they do go together, and in a healthy way. And so how does that work? And I think so the Rebbe focuses on these sorts of things in this discourse, in these discourses. And he starts out in the first one, he describes the idea of Exodus. There's the idea, Exodus is a paradigm. The Exodus from Egypt is actually a paradigm of personal transformation and personal growth. So the idea, the word Mitzrayim in Hebrew, which is a Hebrew word for Egypt, literally means constraints. And the idea of Yitziat Mitzrayim, going out of constraints, is entering into a relationship with God in some meaningful way, which as happened 3.5 millennia ago with the people of Israel as a whole. But there's this idea that every day, every person is supposed to remember and experience Exodus. And in this process of experiencing Exodus, we have to remember that the Israelites didn't instantaneously go from Egypt, which means constraints, to what's called Eretz Tova or Rechava, to the land that's good and broad and wide open. They didn't. There wasn't a 180. They didn't do a quickie from one to the other. They spent 40 years wandering in the wilderness in order to integrate what they were going through in order to have it be something lasting and something real for them. So too, in a person's growth, a person's individual exodus, daily exodus, there's a lot of integration that has to happen. And so here the Rebbe focuses on, in this first discourse, the discourse 1962 on Purim, he focuses on that, on the slow, gradual process that's necessary to really have a stable transformation, where you don't look at, in my own words, like sometimes this is, the Rebbe doesn't say this, but I'm just, sometimes, like, you see a guy, he looked one way, and then you meet him a couple of weeks later, and the guy looks like he fell out of the shtetl in Eastern Europe from 200 years ago or something like that, or from the religious neighborhood in Jerusalem. I don't recognize the guy, but he also probably doesn't recognize himself. And the reason that he made this transformation, I mean, people can have issues, they can have psychological issues regardless of religion, but sometimes, you know, maybe they didn't, but they thought, oh, this is right, this is a good thing, this is the right, this is a correct path, so I'm going to do it regardless of whether I'm there or not. And then at a certain point, life, as he'll describe in this discourse, for part of the normal, in the normal course of spiritual growth, God throws challenges at people. And then there'll be a certain point, if a person jumps in too quickly or transforms quickly, not an internalized way, then the person will say, and that was very nice, but that's not who I am. I'm not there. And then he'll get rid of it. He'll chuck it just as quickly as he jumped into it. He'll jump out of it. I know many people who went through that. You know, one day they show up, you know, they look, they, you know, with a frock coat and then a short haircut, and they start sprouting their beard and things like that. And then 3 years later, they don't even wear a head covering anymore, and they don't keep kosher anymore. So, I mean, that's, I know that many, you know, many people. So he speaks about the incremental process here. And he speaks a little bit more. So what is this idea of going out of Egypt? And where do we start off? What's our starting point? Even in Egypt, we're not totally bereft of any connection to God. We have one thing in Egypt. When Moses showed up in Egypt and he told the people, God spoke to me out in the desert, you're going to be redeemed. They didn't think that he's crazy. They didn't want to lock him up or things that, or, you know, and put him in the psychiatric ward. They actually believed him. So the belief, emunah, a certain of basic belief, is part and parcel of the people of Israel. That someone always has that. That's the Rebbe's contention. That's what the Rebbe says here. Belief is natural. But belief is not something that's internalized. It's not because we believe things, therefore our mind works a certain way, or our heart works a certain way, or our actions follow in that way. It's just something that's up there. It's an ultimate thing. Under extreme circumstances, we may respond to that. But in day-to-day life, the belief doesn't really have an effect on us. But it's a starting point. It's something there. And so even in the constraints of Egypt, we have that one connection, that ultimate fundamental connection to God, although it doesn't really affect us in detailed ways in life. And so the job is to take that truth that we have with our belief and to work with it until we come to the point that we integrate it in our way of thinking, in our way of feeling, in our way of acting, in our ideals, in our aspirations. And he gets into great detail in how that's done here. I'm not going to get into all the detail. Now, he said that people have transformative experiences. Something touches them, this level of belief, somehow it flashes out. And why is that not enough? And he says that it's what we call, in his parlance, he called makif. That's something that touches a person from beyond, from outside. And easy come, easy go. It's an inspiration that happens to a person and it wears off. So after that first flash, a person then has to hold on to it and say, what can I do? How can I internalize? How can I go through those 40 years of wandering in the wilderness and deal with myself? And where I am and who I am, so I can eventually integrate this, I can internalize all of this. And he says the clue to this is in a verse, and we have the verse that God, the prophet, says, I remember the love of your youth, or the loving kindness of your youth, that you followed after me. Lech tech acharai bamidbar, you followed behind me, after me in the desert, in the wilderness. Now he says this idea of after me, behind me, is a very important idea. The idea there, because there are two relationships that we can have with anything, with God or with anything. One is called behind, acharai, from the back, and the other is face-to-face. And the difference is that when we have a relationship with God that's back-to-back, or we're not facing God, we believe in God, we're open to God, but at the same time, we don't say about God, that's all there is, and God's way is my way, and that's the only truth. We say, you know, that I hear that it's a voice, but I have other voices too, and I have their other perspectives, and I'll balance everything out and see what I come up with. But when you're face-to-face with God, you actually experience God, and God becomes real in a different way. For example, we have a faculty called Chochma. Chochma means the ability to have something enter our consciousness that wasn't present in our consciousness before. This can happen in a way of acharaim from the back, which means that we have a new piece of information for us to weigh and to consider. Or it can happen in a different way, that we actually have an experience. It's like a visual experience. Something becomes alive for us. We see something. It's as if it's tangible. So that's chokhmah in a way of panim el panim, face to face. So the mistake that some people make when they have an experience, when they're inspired, when they start becoming religious, and they say, oh, this is great, this is beautiful, this is the right thing, I'm jumping in, is that they don't realize that they are not yet there. They are still achar. They are still achare. They haven't come to a place in their inner psyches where their whole beings and their whole selves are totally integrated with God. They come to the place where something opened up. It's very nice. It's very beautiful. And so you have to do internal work to come from the point where it's just a nice thought, a new idea, a new concept, a new piece of information that entered your psyche, till you come to the point where it becomes real and alive as if something that you're seeing. So that's a process. That's a long process. It's a process of walking from behind through the desert for 40 years. Now the danger of not going this route is seen in a few cases that discussed in the Torah, in the Bible, where that wasn't done. Now, one case is with the first human beings, at Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve were created, and by this, as a story in the first couple chapters of Genesis, were created by God, plunked down in this amazing garden, the Garden of Eden, and given a command by God, anything else you can have except for this one fruit, the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And of course, as we expect, they ate from that one tree that they're told not to eat from. And without getting into all the complexities of it, Rebbe points out that is what happens when God steps in and overwhelms people or does things for people instead of letting them develop and work it through for themselves. That's sort of a natural consequence. Yes, they saw a very true and a very beautiful thing and an amazing thing, but they hadn't worked it through. And part of the process, fundamental to the process of working things through, he said, is undergoing trials and tribulations and challenges. That is an integral part of internalizing something. Without the trials, without the tribulations, we don't internalize things. It's not that if we're going through a trial, it's not that God rejected you or God is angry at you or he said, you're useless, I don't want you anymore. And going through a tribulation is a growing up experience. It's a maturation experience. It's saying, how much did I internalize it? Can I internalize it? Can I overcome this? Now, if your entire connection to God or to religion or to spirituality is because you saw something that was cool and it looked great and you jumped into it without internalizing it, then the minute it gets tough, the minute it gets too difficult, since you are not integrated and it's not you, however nice and however great and however real it is, it's just not you and you're going to leave it. So that's not the root. The root is from the acharai, realizing I'm not there. I'm not a saint at this point in my life. I hear that point of view. I also hear other points of view. I have options. I'm going to work incrementally. And then, and then challenges indeed will come along. But when I have the challenge, I realize, I'm not there yet. I haven't arrived yet. I'm not the greatest saint. I'm not the greatest sage. This is something that's being thrown at me for me to develop myself. It's not shattering me. another example that the Rebbe gives is what happened at Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai, the people experienced theophany, they experienced the revelation of God, and they get Ten Commandments. And one of the Ten Commandments is not to have any other God, not to make idols and things like that. And then then Moses said, I'm going up to the mountain, I'll be back. And they panic and they think Moses is not coming back, so they make an idol. Very soon after they heard the Ten Commandments and not to make an idol. And the Rebbe said, well, what do you expect? They had 7 weeks of preparation from the time they left Egypt from being slaves until they got this revelation. 7 weeks is not a long time. It's a very brief amount of time. And then they're plunked. They have this great revelation of God, that amazing, and they come out with some commandments, some normative content, not only the experience of the revelation, but also normative content. How much could they have internalized in 7 weeks? Then the Rebbe asks in another discourse in the Shmini Atzeret of 1979. He said, "Well, don't we always learn that those 7 weeks are very important, and you go through a transformative process in the 7 weeks, and every year we try to do that again through the 7 weeks? So why do you say that the 7 weeks? Why do I say? Why does one say the 7 weeks are not enough?" He said, "The 7 weeks are enough for something, but not for something else. 7 weeks are enough to be receptive to hear." Without 7 weeks, you wouldn't even hear. God could reveal himself, and God can give content and would just pass you by. 7 weeks are enough that you open up enough to be receptive. But after you're receptive, to actually internalize, you need years. You need 40 years in the desert, or you need whatever, at least 10 years, something you need. You need some good amount of time. So that's what happens when great revelations are thrust upon a person and the person just jumps into them without internalizing them, a challenge will come along. Like in the story of the Garden of Eden, the snake comes along. The snake, the rabbis tell us, it's a messenger of God. It was an evil inclination. It was there. It's actually a messenger of God to test them. And they're not going to pass the test. Or Moses will not come down when they expected Moses to come down. That's again another test, another trial comes along, and they'll panic and they have to make an idol. Well, that's normal. That's expected. They didn't internalize any. They jumped in the deep end, and that's all you're left with. Okay. But now we still have a problem, though. Even if you realize it's a long, integrated process, the problem that remains is, we said until now, that God is going to throw tests and trials at you. So even if you don't do the immature, quickie conversion sort of thing, but one day I look like this, the next day I look completely different, then I don't recognize myself. Even if I'd realize, no, I have to go acharei, I have to go lechtech acharei b'midbar, we have to realize we're still distant, and we have to think, and we have to work, and do internal work, and internalize, and come to understand, until we come to the point that things become clarified and stand out to us. But what's going to give us the strength when God does throw those trials at us, which are part of a natural part of our growth? What's going to enable us to have the strength to not get torn apart like the people who didn't do the internal work? And we see indeed the Amalekites, the people of Amalek, come along, and they come when the people of Israel are on their way out of Egypt, they come after them. Now, Amalek is different from other nations. The other nations, we speak that the people of Israel were going to go into the land of Canaan, which is the land of various nations, and they're supposed to transform whatever the spiritual attribute of those nations is. They're supposed to transform those attributes and bring them to take those same attributes, those same attitudes, but focus them on God. However, Amalek was different. The Amalekites were different. For some reason, they're called Reshit Gayim, the beginning of all the other nations, and who eventually are going to perish. So what was the problem with them? There's a phrase in the Talmud that's applied to something else, but the Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi applies it to Amalek. He says, the phrase is, they know their creator, and they willfully rebel against him. They just can't bear to have someone else tell them what to do. They can't bear authority. They know God. So this is a challenge that's going to come along. It's going to end people's spiritual growth. So let's say, oh, so they didn't jump in the deep end. They realize they have to go incrementally. I have to go one step at a time. But while we're going one step at a time, and they know something, they'll have the question: Why should I listen? Why should I? And so what is there to give spiritual strength to them at those moments? So if we look at the challenge that happened in the desert, Moses said to Joshua, "B'char lanu anashim, pick men for us." And these are called the men of Moses, men of Joshua. So the idea being that each person we mentioned at the beginning, every person has faith. Every person has that core. Even in Egypt, every person has faith. There is a core. There is a core truth that every person has. And there are certain people who embody that in a very intense way. Moses, Joshua, these sorts of people. So basically, the people of Moses, the people of Joshua, these are the people that even when we go through a rough spot, we go through a hard time in our process of integrating, we know that there's a certain depth. We know we're not there yet, but we know it exists. And being aware of that depth of the men of Moses and the men of Joshua, until now I was speaking about going incrementally. So at the same time that we're working incrementally, we have to know there is a lot more there than my increments. We have to know that I did glimpse a higher truth. There is a higher reality. I may not be able to process yet. I may not be able to process it yet. I may not fully grasp it, but I'm aware that it exists. Being aware of that dimension gives a person the strength, and admitting that I don't yet understand it fully, and I didn't process it yet, and it's going to take a long time to process, rather than thinking I got it all because I jumped into it. That gradual process allows one to be aware that there is more than what I attained, and that I have the tools now to work my way towards it. In the next discourse, the Rebbe speaks a little bit more about this idea of Moses and Aaron, and how Moses and Aaron, and it's based on the verse, how God gave a revelation to Moses and Aaron about renewal, about the calendar, about the new month, even while they were still in Egypt. And we said before, Egypt means the constraints and the confinement. So even while one is still constrained, whether fully constrained or partially constrained in one's spiritual and religious life and one's relationship to God, even at that moment, even in that low place, there still is a revelation that comes through Moses and Aaron. Through these great people, there's an awareness that there is, and finding that inside of ourselves, and inside of ourselves, that's basically the idea that despite all of my increments and despite my questions, there is some core that's non-negotiable. There's some core truth, there's some ultimate truth that I'm aware of that's non-negotiable. So I glimpsed it, I may not be there yet, but these people make it present for me, and I find within myself I have an awareness of that dimension. I'm not going into that very much here, touching that very, very lightly. And now I'm moving on to my major focus here is, so what exactly is this incremental work? And what is this ultimate truth that a person is supposed to confront oneself with? So we said until now, so the approach is not to do a quickie, the approach is to be incremental, to realize that there is an ultimate truth, but I'm not yet at that ultimate truth. And instead of trying to externally conform myself to that ultimate truth, I have to go incrementally and try to build my understanding of that. But what is actually that ultimate truth that we're supposed to glimpse and become aware of and try to, little by little, incrementally conform ourselves to? And that's where ecstasy, the ecstatic experience, becomes very important. And the Rebbe spells out in this third discourse two models of ecstasy. One is ecstasy of Nadav and Avihu, the two sons of Aaron, who went, we don't know exactly what happened, but they did something that was out of the ordinary, and somehow their souls were burnt out of their bodies, as it's seemingly, and they experienced an ecstatic death, and they never came back. Now, that's not necessarily a terrible thing. Could be that that's actually what they were seeking. They felt that they were distant from God here in this physical world, and they wanted to actually leave this physical world behind, and they actually accomplished that. But never, despite that, although that voice, that idea is put forth in the rabbinic literature and the analysis of the story, nevertheless, there's also a sense that there was a shortcoming, there was a mistake, there was something lacking or something problematic in what they did. And now we have another example, another model of ecstasy, which is Isaac. Now, if you look at the rabbinic commentators on the chronology of Isaac, you see that there's a problem in the chronology. There's a problem of 2 years. There's a difficulty without getting into the details of that. So according to some opinions, he actually experienced some kind of near-death experience on the altar when he was bound by his father. And there are all different interpretations of how his father did something there or didn't do something to him, but the line of interpretation brought in this discourse is that there's a concept that a Jew has to be ready to surrender his or her life under certain circumstances. It's called Mesirat Nefesh, giving your life up, which means that the bond that one has with God is so profound and so fundamental that it's even bigger than our life in this world. It's an infinite bond, and certain things would violate that bond. We'd rather die than violate that bond. The bond is an internal, isn't it? So, and a person should always be prepared to give one's life away. But the Rebbe says there are different ways of being prepared to give one's life away. One says, I'm not giving my life away. If it comes to it, I'm ready to do it. But at the moment, I'm very involved. I'm eating supper now. I'm enjoying the food. If it comes to it, I'm ready. You know, I'll give my life up. But that's very distant, very remote. It's a theoretical thing. And when it actually comes to it, who knows what's really going to happen. When Isaac was up there on the altar, he wasn't like that. When Isaac was on the altar, his father bound his hands and his feet and said that he stretched his neck out on his own. And he already was there. He already had an ecstatic experience. He already had a near-death experience. Even though his father didn't do anything to him, he already was beyond and the beyond. However, he didn't completely die. He still... They say there was a 60th of life still, 1/60th of his life was still in him. And when the Rebbe relates this to other stories, we hear stories about certain rabbis who went into trances, or some saints or very great people that would go into a trance. Even in our generations, there are certain mystics, great people who bond with God, and you can walk past them and tap them, and the body is still breathing, and the heart is pumping, but the consciousness is completely somewhere else. There's stories, and these things still go on today. The Rebbe goes even further. He says that if you read the code of Jewish law, it speaks about prayer. And in the discussion of prayer, it says that every person during prayer is capable of reaching a level which is close to becoming abstracted from the physical. But even at those moments, the body is still alive. And that's a fundamental difference between the sons of Aaron who left. So what was the underlying truth that the sons of Aaron saw? And what's the underlying truth that other people saw that they didn't do this? They didn't completely sever from the body. They came back eventually, like Isaac. And we see the same issue. How are we doing with time, Rabbi Eli? I mean, so we see the same issue in the famous story in the Talmud, which is also brought in the Midrash, speaks about four entered paradise. One of them was Rabbi Akiva. He was the leader of the group, and he gave instructions to the other people who were with him when they went through that ecstatic experience. And in some versions, it said Rabbi Akiva came out in peace. He came out whole. But the other three who went with him didn't come out at all, or didn't come out in peace, didn't come out whole. But some versions add, not only did he come out in peace, but he went in peace. And so that raises this. So we see the same dichotomy, or the same two models between the sons of Aaron, or like the three colleagues of Rabbi Akiva, who went in but didn't come out. They went into the ecstatic experience, but they didn't come out of it. Versus Rabbi Akiva, who went into the ecstatic experience and he came out of it, and he went in peace and he came out in peace. So what made the difference? And what is the ecstatic experience that they were seeking? Now, the ecstatic experience that he went to, it says, Nichnas b'shalom. He went in peace, and he came out b'shalom. What does shalom mean? Shalom, we translate peace, hello and goodbye. But shalom really means wholeness, integration. We were speaking about integration before. So there are two basic motives in seeking ecstatic experience. And this actually links up with two models brought in the rabbinic literature. One is that a person knows what reality is. He knows that I am distant from God. God is distant from me. And I have to undo myself and get rid of myself in order to get the truth. And my goal really is to have that experience. I want that thrill or that rush or that ultimate experience. And as long as I'm embodied, I'm never going to have it. So I want to become unembodied, get rid of my body, die, and then I can leave the lie behind and come to truth. That's one model. That's like the sons of Aaron. And what they thought, basically, it actually matches up with there's a discussion in rabbinic literature. There's the idea of going to the mikveh. Mikveh is a natural pool of water. And when various purification processes in Judaism require a total immersion in this pool of water without anything interrupting between the person immersing and the water. It's like a rebirth. You go back into the womb, maybe, or how that's not the reason given in rabbinic literature, just to conceptualize what it is. And then you let go of yourself and somehow you emerge and you're reborn, emerging from the water again. Now, there's a question. What if you immersed in water and between you and the water there was a fish? Is that considered an interruption, and that you weren't totally in the water, and so you weren't really totally surrounded by it, or not? So there is an argument about this in the rabbinic literature. One opinion is that it is considered something intervening between you and the water, and the immersion wasn't a good immersion. There's another opinion that says, if you look at the story in Genesis of how fish were created, it says, let the water spawn fish. Since fish came from the water, and they can't live outside of the water, therefore it's actually not separate from the water, and therefore the immersion is a good immersion, because it's really all one thing. And that's how Nadav and Avihu looked at, and the two sons of Aaron looked at themselves as fish in the water. But they felt, even though we come from God, and we can't live without God, even as we're alive, nevertheless we became something else, and they couldn't bear that becoming something else, and they wanted to get rid of that, they wanted to die, to just go become just water and not be fish in the water anymore, so to speak. But now that's not the model embraced by Rabbi Akiva, though. Rabbi Akiva had another insight. He said, don't look at yourself as fish in the water. There is another verse that says, just like water reflects the face that shines into it, so too the heart of one person to another. So the way the Rebbe explains it, Rabbi Akiva went in peace and wholeness, realizing that God is not only up there. God is down here too. God is the details are as much part of God as the negation of details, as the simplicity of the simple infinity. So unlike the two sons of Aaron, who looked at themselves as fish in the water and wanted to become no longer fish in the water, but just the water itself, Rabbi Akiva looked at himself as the water. But the water doesn't negate the face that is reflected in the water. Because two interesting things. If you look at a face in the water, and just to reintegrate what I'm speaking about, think, what is the sort of thing, what is the awareness that a person should have in his religious journey and his trying to experience spirituality and his ecstasy that's going to fortify him and give him the strength that even when he meets challenges along the way, he will be able to persevere and go forward. So it's this insight. It's this insight that we are not fundamentally separate from God, that we came from God and we depend on God, but we became something else. But this insight that we are not fundamentally separate from God. The face reflected in the water, there are two things about it. Number one, there's actually no face that becomes a thing. All that, it's just the water. All that's there is water. You can't like grab the face and pull it out of the water like you can grab a fish and pull it out of the water. So the face that's reflected, although there is an image and it's not simplicity, the water is simple and pure and the face is not simple and pure, but there is actually no separate substance to that face. It's just water, it's just a reflection in the water. And so on the one hand, there's nothing to it. On the other hand, there's water to it. It is water, it's nothing other than water. Ah, but where does the face come from? So God would be the water, the simplicity, the purity, and we would be the face, but where do we come from? Where does a face, how does a face come to the water? So to understand this, the Rebbe speaks about the presence or the existence of us, of the other, within God. And he speaks, he says, in this line, he says that before God created the world, there is a midrash, a story, to try to help us understand these spiritual ideas. Obviously, it can't be taken literally, but it's the deep spiritual truth. Before God created the world, he consulted with the souls of the righteous, whether or not he should create the world. Now, the question, where did the souls of the righteous come from? No one existed yet. All that was there is God. And what would happen if the souls of the righteous told God, don't bother, it's not worth it, don't do it? Then God wouldn't have created. So how did God know that he would get his desired outcome? The Rebbe explains that the souls of the righteous, what is that referring to? It's referring to God anticipated the great pleasure he would have in the relationship. So the souls of the righteous are not something that existed separate from God. They are that otherness as it's part of God. The relationship, us, as we are part of God. And that's what Rabbi Akiva says when he told his colleagues, when you get to the place of marble in our journey, when you get to the place of marble, don't say water, water. Now, the way the Rebbe explains that, don't say that there are two waters, that the place of marble, there's idea that there are many barriers between the infinite and finitude, there are many barriers. So we may look at the barriers, we're finite, God's infinite, I have to undo myself, I get rid of myself to come home with God. No, saying, no, it's true that there are barriers and we are not infinite, but all these barriers are actually ways of bridging the infinite and the finite. They're not ways of fundamentally making a separation between the finite and the infinite. So don't think that there's one water on one side and there's another water on the other side and they're two separate waters. Realize that you see marble, and he brings a passage in the Talmud that speaks about the second temple that was made out of marble and looked like waves. It's the idea that marble, and he brings a verse that's creatively interpreted to mean that although you may see stones, within the stone there's actually water. Between, under what you see as a barrier is actually a flow. It's actually something that's allowing a flow to occur. Don't think that they're two different realities. See yourself not as something fundamentally separate from God that has to be undone. See yourself as God sees you, as God's desire for a relationship. That's what I am. What am I, my finitude? I am God seeking a relationship. That's what I am. And therefore, when I, with my finitude, look into the simplicity, the purity of God, God reciprocates. That comes back to us. So God relates to us, steps down through all these barriers to be able to communicate with us and have a flow happening. So when they enter into the ecstasy, they didn't enter halfway. None of them entered halfway. And that's what they had different truths behind in mind. So if you enter into ecstasy fully and openly, thinking that I'm completely messed up and my truth is a lie and I have to get rid of it, you will end up undoing yourself. But if you enter into the ecstasy with the realization that there's shalom, that there's integration, that there's oneness, and your whole ecstasy is just to try to appreciate that, to try to see yourself in a new light, then you're not holding back in your ecstasy. You're opening up completely. But you know that ecstasy has a bigger truth in it, and you will come back out of that experience being able to embody these truths in the details in the here and now. And that's where mitzvot, commandments, come in. Commandments are another way of bridging that to where I spoke about before, spirituality and religiosity. And here's where the two come together. when a person has that spiritual truth, that spiritual insight, that God can be present in the details, well, how do you embody that? How do you embody God's truth in the finite, in the here and now, in the details? And that's where the specific commandments come in. That is where the water flows through, seemingly through barriers, but they're really bridges. And we find inside of ourselves, subjectively and objectively in our actions, we find a way to bring that ultimate oneness down into the finitude. Thank you.
Questions?
I don't know, thank you very much. Truly inspirational talk. I don't know the name of the rabbi who came back from Pardes and became a heretic.
Acher, Elisha ben Abuya.
Now, my question is, I wouldn't know from personal experience, but I'm just trying to imagine. If someone had at least a glimpse of God, how would they cope with the sense of not futility, because they're not futile.
Not what?
If someone had a glimpse of God, and they came back, how would they manage, how would they cope with knowing that, and forgive me for even advancing this idea, anything that a human could say about God is idolatrous. Or idolatrous.
That's a valid question, a valid point. Interestingly enough, I think that there's a verse. I'm trying to remember which prophet says it. I don't remember which prophet says it, but he said, "I adame beyad hanavim, I made images of myself in the hand of the prophets." So as long as you know that you are giving one refraction of infinity, and it's not a definitive image, it's just expressing a relationship. God as my mother. God as my father. God is power, God is love, as long as you don't essentialize any one of those things.
In this case, or a person, wouldn't be 100% in that. It would be an element of, I know this is the best I can do, but it's not it, because I've experienced whatever, and I know that, and I know that anything else, to the best of my abilities, to the best of my love, my faith, my what I know, the best I can do with my human mind is, forget it, rubbish.
But there's an interesting thing. That's what I was actually, then maybe in the earlier discourse, he deals with that. We have a core in ourselves. We have a core in ourselves which is also beyond our minds and beyond our emotions. We have an essential core. That essential core is the only aspect of us that can really relate to God's essential core, where we go beyond understanding and beyond emotions. We go beyond everything. However, the idea is to revolutionize our understanding and revolutionize our emotions with the awareness of this ultimate thing which is beyond. I think the problem, though, that Acher had was that he glimpsed that ultimate reality and didn't realize that it integrates with the finite. And that's exactly the issue here. So he thought that God, that's the ultimate thing up there, and everything else down here is rubbish, as he said, and therefore that's good up there, but down here, let's just get on with life down here, and then the two don't connect. And I think the insight of Rabbi Akiva was, there's nothing that doesn't connect. Nothing has its own existence that you can say, this rubbish, or that it doesn't connect.
Futile.
He was saying, it's either everything is futile, or everything is meaningful. And that's what Rabbi Akiva was saying. Because of this, because the barrier is not a real barrier, because it's a bridge. And therefore, that ultimate reality that's beyond all of our faculties, makes its way down, and that's actually what we're processing with our faculties and what we're responding to with our emotions. Therefore, instead of everything being futile, everything is absolutely vital.
But is my mind playing tricks on this? My willingness to have this wonderful, to turn myself into a good, you know, spiritual, wonderful person in connection with the ultimate reality. So my mind, is my mind doing that? Or is the mind doing that?
I don't know, maybe both. But I just want to remind you that part of it is realizing I'm not there yet. I see that, and I'm not there yet, so it's a constant every day where I have to do it again. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
We'll take another question.
Yeah. Isn't that, thank you for a beautiful and inspiring talk, isn't that the process where the mitzvot, the commandments, actually are the point where we can bond to God beyond the limitations of the mind? That's... I have a personal image about this, which is not drawn from Jewish teaching. And it's about the story of Perseus, who has to tackle the Gorgon. And if you look at the Gorgon's face and head of snakes, you're turned to stone. So he has a shield. And he looks in the shield, and then he's able to deal with the Gorgon. Now let's transform this into a Jewish teaching. There's the infinite oneness of God, which we cannot look at. Man cannot see me and live. And as you say, everything turns to rubbish. Acher. Yes, it's... But the Torah is the shield of person. And looking at that shield with the mitzvah, the commandments, whether they're the 613 commandments or the 7 Noahide laws, all the time one is in an interaction with that infinite one, and one is able to do it.
It's a message.
It's a matter of discipline of spirit.
Yes.
So the mitzvah are actually dealing with the world on God's terms, so to speak, as the world should be, as the world, what the world means to God, you know, in a certain way. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to thank everyone for participating in this very, very beautiful session. Today, this Yom Limud. We first of all had Dr. Michael Lukin wonderfully with a new perspective on Hasidic melody. Hasidic melody as avodah, as service, like the octave goes higher and higher and higher, so step by step, and the Hasidic melody with its different parts, with its this sense of transformation, of movement, self-transformation. And taking some beautiful sources from Ma'ov Shemesh and Kedushat Levi and Rabbi Shneur Zalman and Nachman of Breslov, showing the depth of Hasidic music in a very beautiful way. And then we had Rabbi Eli Brackman talking about this interesting point with sacred space, profane space. Taking a little patch of Oxford, making it into a synagogue with a mikveh deep down, and then that being sharing, as it were, being taken over and becoming other kinds of building and eventually becoming part of a college. And the whole idea in halachic terms of what happens when you've had a synagogue and it's ruined and it's taken over, what is the halachic reality of someone taking that building, the king taking the building. So there we have another variety of sacred and profane and the borderlines between them. I tried to speak about mystical transactions in Hasidic discourses. In general, and particularly of Chabad, links with the divine, the human and the divine, the Rebbe, the teacher, and the disciples, the Hasidim, and the individual and godliness. And then we had Rabbi Israel Sandman, Dr. Israel Sandman, Rabbi Doctor, with this beautiful presentation of the dialectic of spiritual movement, how to internalize intense spirituality, knowing that there is this intense sacred realm, but then comes the question how to enter in peace so that one is able to come out in peace rather than everything falling apart and the infinite oneness being too great to permit finite life. And so being able to find that point of balance, which, as I understood him, was really a matter of finding the divine within oneself. So thank you very, very much, Ellie, for organizing this, and thank you, everyone, for taking part in these stimulating discussions.
Thank you. Thank you.